One, two, three, four!
So I am here with Mike Lee, who is the man behind Topsy Turvy, Life is Sweet, Bleak Moments, a whole host of films, and most recently, the man behind Happy Go Lucky. Mike, how are you doing?
Hi, you missed out Naked.
Naked, of course, of course, as well as High Hopes, but we can talk about all this later. I wanted to, first of all, ask you about a running motif that is throughout all of your films, and that this film actually calls to mind. I mean, much of your films deal with these vocational symmetries. Life is Sweet, of course, you have two chefs. Home Sweet Home involves three postmen. And in this, of course, you have a variety of teachers. But the interesting thing about, for example, Scott, in his final scene, without giving anything away, he does say, I'm a good driving instructor. So it is this very affirmation of a vocational identity. And I wanted to ask you about how vocation and multiples of vocations enter into your work and help you find a particular premise over the course of several months before you actually plan your film. Is this a good way of answering Oscar Wilde's notion of work is the refuge of people who have nothing to do, or what?
Well, I think, first of all, Oscar Wilde, with all due respect, was being more than singularly cheeky when he said that. It's quite a hard question that you've sprung on me, really. I haven't really ever stopped to consider those collections of people doing the same job that you find in my films. I suppose I'm thinking on my feet a bit here. I think that when I've been instinctively drawn to putting on the screen three postmen or several teachers or whatever it is, and I've done it in other even work that you haven't seen. I made it at a play which was about two doctors and so on and so forth. I think probably what I'm doing instinctively is, apart from anything else, is doing what I do on all sorts of levels in my film, which is to look at a community. So if there's a certain homogeneity about a particular community, that's to say, these are people who are all teachers, it enables us to look, to make comparisons within the community, to evaluate, you know, the merits or demerits or qualities or problems or predicaments or strengths or weaknesses of one of them against the other, and thus draw some conclusions about what this is about. So, I mean, you know, yes, Happy Go Lucky is a film about, on one level, this is not all it's about by any means, about education, about teaching and learning. I mean, we have Poppy and indeed the other characters around her who are school teachers, Poppy, flatmate Zoe, and indeed there's a headmistress and another teacher. Poppy is a very good teacher, and that of that there's no doubt whatever. You then see a flamenco teacher who is actually a very good teacher but has failed to learn the first rule of teaching, which is you leave your personal emotional baggage outside the classroom.
Yes.
And then you've got this guy Scott, who is convinced he's a good teacher, who pontificates about educational principles and things, who in fact, you know, in a moment of great insecurity that you referred to, you know, still is desperately hanging on and saying, I'm a good driving instructor. Well, the fact is, he's a lousy teacher. He actually has no idea how to teach. You know, he's crap. But the film, therefore, is a reflection on, without it being, you know, you can't say, Happy Go Lucky, this is the film about education. But it is a film where education is one of the things that is at least reflected upon, which is what I think I do. And it's a reflection on education, on teaching and learning, certainly.
Well, I want to touch upon this notion of education later in relation to another question, but I do want to ask you about the notion of happiness, which I believe is very well symbolized by the jewelry that Poppy wears. She wears these large earrings and these bracelets, all circular and elliptical jewelry, which I find quite interesting because it's almost as if you suggest that she's caught in this happiness cycle, so to speak. And then, before this moment that we're alluding to, she actually takes off the jewelry, which is a very striking moment, because this also answers the question of, well, is she going to behave like an adult that her sister puts to her? But I wanted to ask you about the idea of the jewelry representing this happiness cycle, so to speak.
Well, before we can think about that question, I think I have to probably question the premise of the question.
Okay.
Because I don't think it's at all accurate to see Poppy's state of mind and attitude to life and general disposition as being in any shape or form locked in a cycle of happiness. You know, the film is called Happy-Go-Lucky. Mm-hmm. That evokes an atmosphere, a spirit. It is not a scientific... It is not the label on the bottle that describes what is in the bottle. It really isn't. Poppy is not somebody... I mean, no, she's been wrongly, I think, talked about in some quarters as being relentlessly happy. This is a nonsense. She is not relentlessly happy at all. She is not happy in the sort of delirious, mindless, airhead, bimbo way, as though she'd got half her brains missing, or though she was basically unintelligent, or indeed as though she'd eaten a lot of magic mushrooms and smoked a lot of dope. I mean, she's actually somebody who is fulfilled. She's focused. She's intelligent. She's mature. She's a grown-up. She's sensible. She's responsible. She takes her work seriously. She's a good teacher. But she has a great sense of humour. She has a great joie de vivre. She's full of beans. She has an anarchic streak, which is perfectly healthy. And sometimes her sense of humour gets the better of her, as is the case with all of us who have a highly developed sense of humour, when we're confronted by somebody who is pathologically devoid of a sense of humour, which Scott, the driving instructor, is. So I think to start to talk about her circular jewellery, and it's only circular because a lot of jewellery is symmetrical by its construction, as being some way a function of or related to a sort of cycle of happiness that she's locked into, I think is sort of a fundamental nonsense. What is, I agree, interesting, of course, is that at a certain point in the game, she takes it off. She takes it off when she's feeling very good about herself. You know, she's just been out with this guy. She spent the night with him, you know, and she's actually had, she's, you know, and she just doesn't feel like wearing it. It's just one of those days, she says. I mean, the interesting thing about it for students of the practicalities of filmmaking is that we knew that the next sequence was going to be the sequence with Scott, which was going to involve a lot of struggling and tussling in the car. And we'd had quite a lot of trouble with the jewellery during the course of the entire shoot because it was very noisy on the soundtrack. You know, we had to do all kinds
it's
of
it's almost every scene I hear the
every
jewelry.
Scene. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and you hear very little of it because when we've cleaned it up and it was taped to her wrists and all kinds of stuff, which is what happens on film. And then we sort of considered this and I sort of said to Sally, well, I think... Do you think we could find the motivation for her to not wear jewellery? Because she changes in a hurry for a driving lesson. And she said, yeah, that makes real sense. And she feels good about herself. I think, yeah, let's go for it. So that's why that happens. And it all sort of becomes organic and makes sense. But as to the jewellery as a symbol of cyclical anything, I don't know whether I go along with that.
Really. Okay, well, fair enough. But I mean...
Nice try.
Well... Let's talk about another possible symbol, the back pain that she experiences. This, to me, suggests that here you have Poppy moving forward as her specific identity, happy-go-lucky, and yet there is this pain in the back, and of course she laughs it off while she's at the chiropractor's office. But the thing that's fascinating about this, to me, is that, well, this is behind her, so it's almost as if she kind of has her blinders on her. She's so focused in on moving forward that she doesn't notice what is she's actually feeling in the back. And I'm wondering, how much one should read symbols into these particular choices.
I think as we progress into this conversation, I think you are plainly a fundamental, unreconstituted, top-rate intellectual, which I'm not. I think it's fascinating, your analysis, but I think it's a load of old rope, basically, and I can't go along with it at all. I mean, the fact is, she gets a pain in the back because she pulls her back when she's trampolining, and it happens to be her back because That's what she pulls, the back muscle. I think what's more interesting about that unfortunate thing that happens to her, which she gets fixed by, is an osteopath, not a chiropractor, by the way.
My apologies.
No, you couldn't. You know. But I think what is interesting, I've found, is that, you know, a lot of people, this has nothing to do with your question, but it's talking about the same part of the film, same aspect of what happens to Poppy. People, you know, people are conditioned by, you know, mainly courtesy of Hollywood, into, you know, the inevitability that something terrible is going to happen. And, you know, a number of people have thought, oh, she's got cancer of the kidneys. That's what this film is about. Partly because the last film I made was about, you know, an abortionist, yeah. You know. The fact is, it's not about that. You know, people say, well, couldn't something terrible have happened to her in the film? Did you think of that? I said, no, because that's not what it's about. Yeah, of course, she could have. This could be coming from about a woman who dies of cancer of the kidneys, but so what? It's not what it's about. It's about somebody who deals with stuff and is positive.
You also quibbled in another interview over people identifying Scott as a taxi driver instead of a driving instructor.
No, people say that scene with a taxi driver. I mean, I find that just... it's amazing the number of people in everywhere, here in Paris, in London, in Berlin, when we talk to international press, who call him a taxi driver. And it's very curious. It's as though, you know, this is a film about an airline pilot and people call him a doctor. You know, it's very strange.
I mean, I'm wondering, could it be the way that you actually shot him? Because I know that you and Mr. Pope actually used lipstick cams to get...
No, come on. You cannot construct any correlation between how the film was shot and the fact that for some reason people call a driving instructor a taxi driver. You really can't do
that. So it's the audience's problem, not yours.
No, it's not. It's just a weird thing. I mean, I don't think it's even a problem. It's just it's a strange quirk, but it's one of those things, but I don't think any very much should be made of it, really. I certainly don't think you can construct a theory that links it with the way the thing was shot. I really don't.
I wanted to ask you, actually, about... I'm not sure if you're familiar with Bechdel's rule. There's a cartoonist named Alison Bechdel who has posited this rule that essentially a movie that has a conversation with two women, but they don't talk about a man. And this is interesting to me in light of looking at this film and also Career Girls and also the very interesting woman throughout your particular films. I wanted to sort of ask you if you were aware of this rule or if you've thought about this notion of pushing a female character into a relationship, whether you have possibly resisted any impulses over the years to immediately sort of put her together with some guy or whatnot, or whether this idea of a woman essentially being able to exist as a character without being tied to a particular man or being
in
a relationship.
Well, first of all, I've never heard of the theory or the cartoonist, no disrespect to her. I don't really do anything on the basis of theories or I just talk about people. And indeed, that's what will be my response to the main part of your question, because although obviously I think in terms of characters in films, and because that's what I'm doing, actually, what I'm primarily concerned with in the context of whether I have women without relationships or men without relationships or men in relationships or people in appropriate or inappropriate relationships, that's all about life. It's about, you know, all these things exist and I deal with them because they are real, basically, rather than thinking about them in a kind of semiotic, symbolistical, contrived kind of way.
But there are some semiotics in this. I mean, for example, the no exit sign that Poppy is going through in the manual, and then I noticed that the no entry sign pops up at a Tesco station later on. It's almost, again, going back to the circular metaphor, this could very well just be my own...
It is. It is, absolutely. I mean, it's your prerogative to decode the film in this very interesting... cryptographic kind of graphical kind of way, but I haven't thought in these terms at all.
But you do think in terms of color schemes, and you have, particularly in your last I would say 5 or 6 films, colors have mattered more to establish mood, I think, than I suspect in the earlier films where you were essentially trying to get the relationships of the characters together and the like. And I'm wondering how much visuals matter to you, and this also leads me into a question I've always been curious about: where you place the camera, who decides that? You decide that, or do Dick Pope decide that?
Now, first of all, I'm a very visual person. I draw and paint. I went to two art schools, and to me, one of the great joys of film is its visuals. You have seen, obviously, from talking, hearing you, you're obviously familiar with pretty well all of my films, and therefore you are very aware that although they've all been shot by Dick Pope since 1990, when he shot Life is Sweet, that previous to that I've worked with a number of different cinematographers, and yet I think you will agree that if you go through all of those films, irrespective of which cinematographer, you'll find a consistency of visual style. So therefore, that answers your question, really, that in the first and last analysis, I mean, I'm making films according to my own taste and preference and choices of a visual nature. Having said that, of course, one collaborates with a cinematographer, and one doesn't simply dictate to an idiot who points the camera wherever you tell him to. I mean, it's a very much a shared experience, but it has to be a shared experience with somebody who is on the same wavelength and who appreciates what my style and what I'm trying to do. And Dick Pope is preeminent at that, and we have a great rapport. And sometimes I will construct a scene and I'll say, this is it, and I think, you know, we should shoot it like this, and he'll say, fantastic, great, let's put a lens to it. Sometimes he may say, well, yeah, but I was watching it from over here, or yes, it's great, but actually, if we did it like this, the light would do something, you know, and we would then talk it through. But I mean, always, I've got to feel that buzz that is my visual instinct. And, you know, it's a complex thing. I mean, if you look at the very first shot of Naked, he said, well, how do you want to shoot this? And we had this long, dark alleyway with a couple. And he said, well, what do you want to do? How do you want to shoot it? I said, well, I think we want a track to it. He said, well, we can put down tracks. I said, no, I think what you should do is this. I think you should put the camera on your shoulder and run with it. He said, I can't do that. He said, you won't see anything. It'll be all over the place. I said, I'll try it. I said, try it. And he tried it. It was great, you know. Now, that is really a cinematographer's shot. But that was my idea. I suggested it, you know, because I just knew it needed to be, you know, enigmatic and rough and disjointed and discombobulated. And then you'd sort of see it, you know. You'd half catch it and not know what you were looking at. And then you were in on them and seeing this fuck taking place.
Yeah.
Now, the joy of working with cinematographers who appreciate, who are on the same page, on the same wavelength, Dick Pope, as I say, is just that, is that, you know, we can do elaborate, fantastically pyrotechnical things, but when I say, okay, I think it's a static shot, and it just holds, and it all happens within the frame, that's as big a turn on for him, because he likes Ozu as well, and, you know, all the great, you know, that's as big a buzz as, you know, because, you know, it's like, you know, I talk about Ozu, you talk about, you know, Vermeer, you know, I mean, just the spirit, the quality of something happening to people in a space.
So you sometimes abdicate the framing to him so that he can get his Ozu buzz, basically.
No, I'm the Ozu fan.
Well, okay.
I say we both are.
Got it.
No, I don't. Nobody abdicates anything. Mm-hmm. Neither of us abdicates.
Got it. I had a quick question about technology. This is the first film in which you have actually broached the subject. You have, for example, in the Flamenco School, whether this was intentional or not, I'm hoping to get an answer from you, but they do say MySpace, which of course is a major social network. You have also this discussion over drinks about chat rooms and the like. And then, of course, there's the really funny moment with Poppy's sister Helen and her husband over the PlayStation, in which you show this emasculated geek who is just wants to play his video game and the like. I'm curious as to why this particular film, I mean, going back to what we were talking earlier about how this is a film that has many societal glimpses, this reliance on technology.
The short answer to your question is very simple. It's 2008, and these things are going on, and they're there because, they weren't there in the film I did in 1993 because it wasn't an issue, and they're part of the texture of life now, and they're there.
But MySpace and the Flamenco, was that deliberate? Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, actually, the truth is we researched Flamenco classes. Because the actress Karina Fernandez, who plays the teacher, who's rather brilliant, she'd never done flamenco at all, and she isn't Spanish, by the way. Her father is, but she isn't. And the teacher that she went to classes to learn it from had this very good way of motivating the students, motivating the flamenco, the stamping and saying, and it's a very, you know, it's what it's about, saying this is, you know, my, that comes from that. And so she let us use it. Now, but I was amused by it, and simply because of my space, yeah. You know, because it's a gas, you know, it's sort of, it doesn't actually mean anything. It's just fun.
Well, I also wanted to ask you about the scene with the boy and his drawing where Tim and Poppy look at it. But what's interesting about this is that they make an inference entirely from that drawing. They don't actually go and investigate the boy's house. They don't actually try to make some calls. And this seemed to me almost an institutional condemnation of my particular generation of looking at something and inferring from a piece of art, because we've all drawn crazy pictures like that.
The truth is that's a standard technique for school. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's something that the people do. But there's no way that it isn't true to say they don't go and investigate his home. And in fact, actually, there's reference to talking to his mother and things elsewhere in the film. They don't arrive at the conclusions just on the basis of that. But at that moment, it becomes clear that, because what happens is that as a result of him doing that drawing, they draw out of him the truth about the boyfriend hitting him, you know, the mother's boyfriend. But that's not all they do. I mean, but however, that is a standard technique.
Huh, interesting. So it's drawn from reality. Again, brings to mind the notion of subconscious symbolism in reality almost inflects the symbolism that may or may not be in there that the audience chooses to read.
Absolutely, but that's fine. You know.
Huh. I'm curious also about Scott's En Ra Ha, which sounds suspiciously similar to Haru Ra Ha. I wanted to ask you about this. I'm not sure how aware you are of Thelema, which is the Rabelais, Aleister Crowley philosophy that essentially suggests do what thou wilt, which again brings to mind the maxim, those who cannot do, teach. Where did En Ra Ha come from?
Well, first of all, actually it has nothing to do with that at all.
Okay.
What En Ra Ha is, you need to Google. It's a waste of time me telling anybody something that you can easily go and find out in an encyclopedia or by Googling it. We just had the idea that, again, this guy is head full of all this kind of crap. And interesting that you say that, because Aleister Crowley is something that the character would know about, in fact. But hey, it's just part of the general assembly of disjointed, undigested ideas, really.
Which brings to mind another observation that occurs to me about those who read books in this film tend to be rather gloomy. We see the bookstore employee at the very beginning who's rather glum, and then, of course, we see this gentleman who...
You're not paying attention, because actually early on in the film, the two women are sitting there and they say, they talk about flying, and it'll be great to fly, and Zoe says, like Mr. Vertigo. And Poppy says, yeah, I love that book. And she said, yeah, so do I. So, you know, you get straight away early on that they've read Paul Auster.
Yeah, got it. One last question, because I think we're being ushered out here. But I wanted to ask you about going back to the lipstick cams that Dick Pope set up for the car. This was high definition. And I'm curious if you have considered surrendering film, or is this a financial circumstances condition where this essentially dictates how you actually make your films, or whether you're really willing to go completely
the fact is, it's inevitable. And, you know, what can be done digitally now is magic. Not only did we use those little cameras because it would help, I insist that the actors could actually drive the car for real. So that's why we did that, because the driving in that circumstance, just pretending to drive on a low loader simply wouldn't work. It would inhibit the action terribly. If film ceases to exist, we will be very happy to use digital technology. Digital technology was immensely useful anyway. I mean, actually, in Vera Drake, there was a famous scene where she gets interrogated by the cops, and it rained on a glass roof throughout the entire weekend. We shot that scene and we were in despair, but the sound editor was able to go into a room for 4 days and peel off the sound of rain and leave the the rest of the track intact, which you couldn't have done till recently. The fact that we've used a mixture in the driving lesson scenes of 35 millimeter motion picture camera and also these high definition cameras, the fact that those two modes are mixed in those sequences and you cannot see the difference, you would not know how or where the joins are, is courtesy of digital grading. It's magic. I would not doubt for a moment that it's pretty likely that I'll wind up shooting a picture on a digital format, and the technology is there to do all kinds of magical things. I look forward to it. But, you know, we shot Happy-Go-Lucky on a brand new stock invented by coincidentally invented by Fuji, called Vivid, which lends itself to primary colours. Fuji wouldn't be bringing a new motion picture stock onto the market if film was about to evaporate, basically. So I think film, which we carry on shooting on because we love it, because what you can do with film is fantastic and the magic of photography is, you know, will take some beating. We'll carry on shooting on film while it's there, but at the same time, the new technology exists and let's embrace it. So, hey.
I wonder if you've resisted any lower budget opportunities that were based entirely on video.
I haven't resisted anything.
Got it.
But I'm in love with motion picture technology and with film, and I'm committed to it as far as it goes. But hey, there's no rules.
Well, Mike, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
If you have a friend on whom you think you can rely, you are a lucky man. If you found the reason to live on and not to die, you are a lucky man. Preachers and poets and scholars don't know it. Temples and statues and steeples won't show it. If you've got the secret, just try not to blow it. Stay a lucky man. A lucky man. If you found the meaning of the truth in this whole world, you are a lucky man. Instead of change, you are a lucky man.